This is the MedicCast, March 1st, 2010.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the PodMedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the PodMedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. If you're a brand new listener or an existing listener or whatever you may be as far as a listener of the show, don't forget you can find out links to everything we talk about in this episode and a whole lot more over at mediccast.com/blog. In the blog there, you'll find links in the show notes link at the top of the page for each and every episode, to the news items, to the special guests, the tip segments, additional resources, everything right there for you in each show notes for every episode. And I urge you to do that because that's a great way for you to follow up on the information presented here on the show. Of course, you can also sign up for the email newsletter. You get all those links sent directly to you each and every week, along with other updates and important information from time to time as they pop up here at the MedicCast. And also, always, you can always contact me directly by just leaving a comment on any of the articles over at the MedicCast site. It's a great way to leave your comments and ideas about something you're reading there, as well as sharing your thoughts with the rest of the readers and listeners here on the show. If you'd like to contact me more directly, like get in touch with me by email, podmedic@mac.com is my email address. You can also reach me by the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC is our voicemail line and a great way to catch up with us there. I do want to put out a special shout out. I was down at the National Collegiate EMS Conference, EMS Foundation Conference recently, and was hosting or moderating a panel discussion there about issues in the National Collegiate EMS Foundation's membership and EMS services on college and university campuses, some of the unique issues they face there. I was brought in to help out and moderate that panel. And during the time I was there, I got to meet some listeners to the show and also some people that said their training officer is always telling them to listen to the MedicCast. So I thought that was a great thing. And I wanted to give a special thanks to Ashwin Ramaswamy. Ashwin is a training officer for NYU's student EMS organization. And, you know, Ashwin, thank you very much for pumping up the MedicCast with your peers there and with the people you're working with. And I just want to thank you very much for being a supporter and loyal listener to the show. So please keep in touch and you know, shoot me emails if you have anything you want me to chat about. I do appreciate meeting some of your colleagues down at the conference and really had a great time. Lots of fantastic young professionals in that organization working hard to deal with dealing with the first response unit in a closed community where they may know a lot of the people they're responding for on a personal basis in some cases, especially in these smaller colleges, and also working as an interacting agency for mutual aid for surrounding agencies. And sometimes that's difficult when you come off of a college campus, how you're perceived by surrounding agencies. So I just want to applaud them for continuing to raise the bar for their organization and to continue to be the special young professionals they are in a difficult marketplace in some ways. So thanks a lot for having me down to the foundation, and I look forward to getting out maybe to your conference in future years and meeting some more of you there. Before we get into the special content that I have set up for tonight's episode, I want to remind all of you, coming up this week, later on this week, starting Friday, March 5th, and again on Saturday, March 6th, myself, Chris Montera, and Ted Setla from Ted's from the Chronicles of EMS video programs, and you can find out more at chroniclesvms.com. Chris Montero from the EMS Garage at emsgarage.com, and myself here from the Medicast will all be down at the EMS Today conference, and Chris and I will be producing, each of us, a show a day, Friday and Saturday, from the show floor near the GEMS booth. So if you're going to be at EMS Today in Baltimore this week on Friday or Saturday, definitely stop by and visit with us. My show, the Medicast, will be Friday from noon to 1, sometime in that time frame, starting around noon, going for about an hour. Chris's EMS Garage for Friday starts at 2, runs till 3. And then again on Saturday morning, we'll start off with Chris and the EMS Garage at 10:30. And I'll be picking up and closing out the exhibit hall from 12 to 1. So if you're around and want to stop by and visit, we'd love to see you and meet all the listeners that can come by. If you'd like to participate in the show in some way, we'd try to maybe squeeze you in, fit you into the show. So if you're interested, definitely get in touch with me by email or Facebook or Twitter or some different way to catch up with me. And we will see if we can't squeeze you in if you have some particular topic or something you'd like to talk about. So we're going to be trying to meet up with as many of you as possible. And of course, Friday night, we're having a social media meetup. You can find out more about that over at the Medicast Facebook fan page. But we're going to be meeting over at Baltimore's Harbor Place at the Uno's Chicago Grill for a social media meetup with Chris, myself, Ted, and a whole host of EMS bloggers. And I hope to meet a lot of you there as well. That'll be 8 o'clock in the evening on Friday night, March 5th. For tonight's show, I've got a very special episode. For those of you that listen to the Mitigation Journal podcast with Rick Rosati, you will have heard this already. This is a joint interview that I did with Rick, myself, and with Richard Brooks, who is the Director of Emergency Services for Cecil County, Maryland, EMS, talking about the recent response to the back-to-back snowstorms that hit our region here in the Mid-Atlantic area, and how our agencies in my specific area dealt with just dealt with getting around, responding in the snow. And I was really intrigued to find out kind of that 10,000 foot view. You know, we're on the street and we're dealing with difficult situations, and we wonder why some resources come our way and others don't. And maybe we get annoyed about why those things aren't coming our way. Well, this was a great opportunity for me to hear about why certain decisions were made at the county level, and working with the state emergency response and the county emergency response services, exactly how they were making decisions, why they were making decisions, and some of that mindset. And I think it's important for street providers to hear that type of decision-making process kind of walked through. And boy, this is like a primer in emergency preparedness, hearing this discussion between Rick and Richard Brooks. And I pitched in a few observations, but mostly it was Rick and Richard. So I'm going to pitch over to that here in just a sec. I guess without further ado, let's jump on into that interview segment. It's about 50 minutes long or so, but I think you're going to really enjoy listening to this frank discussion about how decisions are made when responding to disasters and how to prepare for specific disasters. I really learned a lot about, do you prepare for each individual type of event, or do you just have a general response profile? And I think you'll hear the decision-making process involved there. So here it is, Richard Brooks, Director of Emergency Services for Cecil County EMS, Rick Rosati, host of the Mitigation Journal podcast, and little old me, Jamie Davis, the pod medic.
Oh, thanks, Jamie. Thanks for getting this all set up. And thanks to Mr. Richard Brooks, the Director of Cecil County Emergency Services, for taking the time to join us for a little conversation today on the topic of the snowstorms that have really battered your area over the last couple of weeks. So, Mr. Brooks, I'm very interested to hear what impact the storms has had on your area. And I guess the best place to start is really to tell the listeners a little bit about your area and your emergency services in Cecil County.
Sure. Cecil County is a real interesting area. It's a beautiful rural area on Maryland's eastern shore. So we encompass the head of the Chesapeake Bay, the Susquehanna River, and the Chesapeake and Delaware Canal. So it's a rural area. We have about five incorporated towns have population, centers. And then we have a beautiful, thoroughbred and farm country on the south part of the county that heads to the adjacent jurisdiction and down the Delmarva Peninsula. We also have, Interstate 95 that runs right through the heart of the county. The Amtrak lines that run, straight through the heart of the county, actually parallel 95, as well as U.S. Route 40. And we have two other freight railroad systems, one that comes down the Norfolk Southern, that comes down the through Port Deposit and down the Susquehanna River, and then the Chessie systems that run up and down the Amtrak area.
What's your civilian population base in your area?
We're just over 100,000 people, just over. So we're like at 104,000 right now.
Okay. Well, my next question really is really broad. What is, if you can, give us an overview of the situation that impacted you, the snowstorm situation, just a broad overview of it.
Well, it's interesting, the storm. I mean, the nice part of the storm is that we all had ample time to prepare. And it's amazing the naysayers. You can't believe the weather forecast. We don't know that it's really going to be here. But any of us that, are in positions where we have to plan for things, you had to look at these radar models and go, you know what? A lot of these models are agreeing, and we're going to see a significant impact by way of weather. So we had time to prepare, and that was a good thing. We also had time between the storms. We had, because we had two storms back to back. We also had time between the storms to use the first one as a dry run, if you will, although we actually had the dry run in the first storm in December. But between these storms, you had that lull that allowed us to regroup, recharge, restock, and then, implement the same plan for the second storm. That included things, like getting the crew rest areas up and running, getting our resources from our National Guard support, getting the Humvees in place. So a lot of things like that were just good planning. We had those initiatives, but then having to implement it the first time, then the second time, then the third time, it actually got easier. And that's not bad. Those are the positive things that come out of it.
Now, when you said you had ample time to prepare, when was the last time you actually dealt with a storm of this magnitude, or in fact, several storms of this magnitude?
You mean prior to December?
Yeah, exactly.
So prior to December, I think probably the most, significant that I would say would be back in 1996. We had similar storms, and I compare those. As a first responder, as a firefighter, a paramedic, I compare those to what my work habits were during those storms. In 1996, it was a storm that I didn't come home to see my family for 4 days. And the first thing I had to do when I got home was dig myself into the house. That was exactly the same thing that happened in these storms. We were home, away from home for a couple of days at first, and then 3 or 4 days, at the end. And the first thing you have to do when you get home is dig yourself into your own home. Everybody else is clear. And there's even one lane, in the road, in the neighborhood, and you can't get in. So you end up parking in your neighbor's driveway and then, digging yourself out. They're just some of the things that you think of and how you function, in storms like that.
So from 1996 to 2009, early 2010, it doesn't seem like Cecil County has received this type of natural event. It's certainly not a frequent event for you. And really, I wrote in my blog the other day, 30 inches of snow is a showstopper no matter where you are, even if it's Rochester, New York, where we're used to getting those types of storms. So that leads me to my next question then. With that volume of snow and knowing that you had time to prepare for it, what were some of the ripple of effects or the secondary events that came in addition to the snow? And we all know that the routine calls for service are going to continue to come in. But what did the snow cause that you had to deal with as secondary events, or what type of secondary events came as a result of this storm?
Sure, and that's interesting, because in the first and the second storm, we really didn't have what I would call ripple events. In the third storm, we had ripple events. The ripple events were, we had drifting, significant drifting. So we had the road closures that go with that. That becomes a problem. Then you have the ripple effect that, well, wait a minute, 4 days ago we just had 30 inches. Now we're having 30 inches. What do we do with 60 inches of snow? Where does it go? Well, the snow plows become ineffective at that point. So the rubber tired front end loaders, the bobcats for the smaller areas, anything with a bucket on the front, you know, had to be employed to clear the roads. Simple access to areas was priority one. Now the people, the citizens, they were excellent. You know, by and large, they were excellent. But you get a certain group of people that begin to think, it's been 3 days. I want my street plowed. Well, that's not reality. Reality is your street is open, and you need to deal with the road courteously. And that is, if somebody's coming the other way, you pull off in a driveway and you wait, and they go past, and then you travel. And that's a ripple effect that some people can't deal with. And even today, you know, if you go, 30 miles south of here in Baltimore, they're still having that problem. I mean, the mayor of Baltimore today issued, a request, remove the lawn chairs from your parking spaces. Now, fortunately, we're not, in Cecil County, we're rural. We don't get to that point, or at least I haven't seen that. It may be in small areas. But we're still dealing with the ripple effect of a lot of white stuff that's just piled. And it's going to be there for a while, because Mother Nature hasn't cooperated until yesterday to really get us into temperatures above a freezing point that give us any melt-off. Now, we've seen some sublimation because we've had sun out and a breeze, so that allows for that to occur. But there's not a whole lot of water in the streets, with the runoff. So, all those things begin to mount up. And because we're in a, in a tidal basin, we have to be conscious of, of what's happening on our waterfront communities. We have to be conscious of our storm drains clogging with snow, and retaining the water, and then, consequently backing up drainage. We have to be conscious of the Susquehanna River, because the Susquehanna River drains, everything from New York down, and the snow as it begins to move or run off and behind the Conowingo, and then our towns feel the effect of the water once they start to open up gates. So there's a lot of things in the long term that we have to monitor and keep our hands on.
Now, you also mentioned how people were pretty courteous about the whole situation, pretty responsive to the whole situation. I'm interested to hear if or what your thoughts are on the level of preparedness amongst individual families or individuals in the storm. Did you find that folks were paying as much attention to these forecasts and getting themselves ready, extra food or whatnot in the house, or if they were going to other areas? Or how did you see the individual preparedness amongst your citizens?
Yeah, and I'm probably a little more bizarre as a, with one of my roles as emergency manager, I'm probably a little bit more bizarre because I like to use barometers for that. And the barometer is I go over to Walmart. Walmart's right next door. And I look at, and I'm serious, this is true, but it's reality. I go to Walmart and I look at the frenzy of people. I look at the shelves and I look at what people are taking and, what's going on in general. Are people stopping as they're leaving Walmart and carrying on casual conversations with people they know? And that's what I saw, at least into the second storm. I didn't see a frenzy. People had already rehearsed this, in December. So in the second storm, they were just stocking up. They knew it was going to be a significant event. We had told them, and news releases said they were going to be stuck for a while. And they were doing interesting things. So where you saw the toilet paper and the milk and the loaf of bread, you also saw a couple boxes of puzzles in their grocery carts. So that tells you what the family mindset is going to be. We had a number of inquiries, you know, off of our website. Because we listed, you know, the emergency preparedness for storms, the simple things. Because, you know, one of the questions we had from a town commissioner is, well, you all talk about this preparedness, but how are people, you know, supposed to go to your website if, you know, or know that there's a shelter? I'm sorry, a shelter if the power goes out. And we're like, because they have battery operated radios. You know, we've gone to great lengths to publish that material. Now, if they didn't do that prior to the storm, or they didn't take any preparations, well, then we have an issue. But you've got to work on educating your public, you know, to get them to the point where they can function. So, you know, the issues of how is the public prepared? That's a long-term initiative, with constant, you know, through community emergency response teams, through their education, through your website, through general inquiries or presentations that we make to the American Legion, the VFW, the Chamber of Commerce. You always take time to promote the message, and you'll just have a better prepared public in the long run.
And absolutely, I agree with you on the need to keep the public informed. And it's interesting about the comment you made about having a battery powered radio. You'd think after September 11th and all the terrorism and domestic preparedness training and awareness that we've had in this country, that would be a staple item in every house. And I think you and I both know that those simple things certainly are not as common as we'd like them to be. I want to move on just a little bit and just ask you, what actions specific to your emergency responders, what actions did you take in advance of the storm with the advance notice that you had?
Well, one of the things is, you know, we have our 9 fire chiefs of our volunteer fire companies, and they meet regularly. So we, you know, we put out the informational bulletins to them. We use the informational bulletins that come from our National Weather Service and pump those out. We had a lot of inquiries just kind of informally because we haven't seen that much as to whether to use chains on fire apparatus or on ambulances, and those discussions were going on amongst the fire chiefs themselves. We made sure that all of our deputy sheriffs were outfitted in four-wheel drive vehicles, and what we did was we just transitioned the normal use vehicles from the Department of Public Works and from planning and zoning and permits and licensing. We just moved those right to the sheriff's office the day before the storm came in. So basically it was do anything we'd have to do to address moving critical personnel, in a storm, in a snowstorm. We activated the EOC in advance of it, with a staff level, so that we could begin to open lines, make our preparations here so that we were going to have the creature comforts we needed. We visited Walmart as well. I mean, that's important. We got the materials we needed. And then you start to, you know, you just start to touch all your partners that you have. Department of Public Works, you know, are key components. The director and I are close when it comes to storms. Our hospital, our allied police agencies, the 5 town police agencies that come under, you know, this communication system. So you just start to reach out and touch them and address, well, you know, this town had this need. Do you anticipate having a need? And sometimes yes, sometimes no. But giving the leaders of different agencies the information that's going on to spur thoughts that may make them better prepared.
Well, along with that, one of the hallmark issues that's been addressed in emergency management, as I'm sure you know, in the last couple of years, is whether or not we will have sufficient numbers of people returning to work or returning to volunteer positions because of the event, like you mentioned, having to dig yourself out after being at work for a while. Did you run into any personnel shortfalls as a result of the storm for people that chose not to come in to volunteer, chose not to come into work, or physically couldn't get there because of the storm?
Well, we had several employees who physically could not, you know, get out during the storm, but none of them said, I'm staying home. They all said, what can we do? Well, we have, you know, I mean, our fleet of vehicles is all, you know, all four-wheel drive expeditions. We had three Humvees from the National Guard here, so we just established a list of, you know, we established our own bus route. So we're picking up dispatchers and paramedics and, you know, and EOC staff and shuttling them back and forth. And that worked out well. I mean, it was a good use of the resource because then we could get them back and forth so they could go home and they almost had a normal life. I mean, they may have normally had a commute for 15 minutes, and in this case it was 90 minutes, or they may normally, you know, could get into work at, you know, 5:30 or 5:45, and we were picking them up at 3:30 or 4 o'clock, but not one person squawked. They were all glad to come to work. They were glad to, you know, to have the arrangements made for them, and they were also glad that they could go home and get their rest, because our people, obviously, during, you know, that storm did not sleep. I mean, when they were on the 12-hour shift, there was no rest. They were constantly working. I mean, we had to schedule the rest in the EOC because those people were here for 3 or 4 days. But all in all, in the entire agency, I had one person who was out on a sick leave. That was it.
And I think that is a measure of good planning and good training and the front loading of the event. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, I think so. And the other side of that is once the agency, you know, the employees in the agency know that that is the plan and that's what we're going to function or how we're going to function, then they're ready for it. You know, so they're ready to know that that support is going to be there. And in the long run, they appreciate that.
Well, you mentioned use of civilian emergency response teams or CERT teams. So did you implement that plan in this particular event?
No, we did not. And actually, we only in the third storm, we only had one. In the first two storms, we had very minor power outages. In the third storm, we did have a significant power outage in the northeast area, and that necessitated us opening a warming center at the Northeast Volunteer Fire Company. So that was done. So that was about all that we had to do there. We didn't have to reach countywide and start to activate multiple centers or get CERT teams moving or things like that.
Now, knowing that snowstorms, especially, you know, blizzards of this magnitude, are not the norm for Cecil County, how did your emergency planning process come into play here? Does the snowstorms and blizzards fall very high on your threat assessment rank, or is that something a little bit lower on the scale? And how did that whole process play out for you?
Well, we're in the Mid-Atlantic region, so, you know, it's a hand of cards as to what you're going to be dealt on any given day. A snowstorm doesn't have to be a blizzard to incapacitate the Mid-Atlantic, and we're going to see this Monday. You know, this coming Monday, we're going to see an ice storm that we do see regularly. So while we don't see 30 inches of snow, regularly we'll see an ice storm come through with a half an inch, 3/4 of an inch of ice. The incapacitation is almost identical. It's very difficult to move. It's very difficult to get, you know, patients, you know, loaded and transported to the hospital. You can't move employees back and forth. So the plan becomes a generic, you know, a plan on how to accomplish the goals. The other side of that is we go from winter to summer. And, you know, we're on the Atlantic coast where, you know, we watch hurricanes from the time they come out of the throat of the Atlantic. And if they go to the east side of Florida, we're paying attention. If they go into Gulf of Mexico, we breathe for another couple days because we know they'll spin around down there for a while. But, you know, once we get that 2, 3, 4, 5 inches of water, we begin to have similar difficulties. So the plan, and when you talk about plans and you're going to pull one off the shelf, you know, they're not plans for snow. They're not plans for ice. They're contingency plans for, you know, how to prepare, what to do in the event of a natural disaster, and how to move and care for people.
And out of all the people that I talk with regarding emergency planning, that seems to be the number one holdback, is we think we've got to write plans for every specific contingency rather than having a generic emergency response plan with some functional annexes down the road for dealing with those those incident-specific issues. And so I commend you for taking that approach. It seems like not many people in emergency management are willing to take that hands off or step back and take the broad brush approach to it.
Well, and thank you for that. But I think a key point to that is, and it's a mindset, if I have to reach on my shelf and pull down an emergency plan because an event is coming, I failed. All right. I failed. I may use that plan 2 or 3 days into the storm just to look at benchmarks. You know, have we missed something? What are we doing? And I'll give you a great example. In December, one of the things we did in the second day of the storm, we went to great lengths last year to create a special needs registry in our office here. And in the second day of the storm, we were looking at what we needed to do. And so I said, what other resources do we have out there to talk to people? And the emergency planner says, well, what about the special needs registry? And it was like, oh, absolutely. Let's start making phone calls. Let's reach out to the special needs population and touch them. I want to talk to them, not leave a message. We can do that. But I want to talk to them, call back, make sure they're okay, make sure they've got access to medications, make sure they've got a quart of milk, and do they need anything? Now, that's not to say we're going to go grocery shopping, but that's to tell an 80-year-old couple who are independent dwellers who have a 100-foot driveway and nobody's cleared it out and they can't move that we're out here and we care. And if need be, we'll have one of our units stop by, all right, just to say hi, just to sweep off the front porch perhaps. But doing those kind of things and having that plan to trigger that thought, I think, is the most important thing.
And as caring for special needs population seems to be an ever-growing issue in emergency management, that is really paramount, not only of taking care of people during the event, but I would think of building support for your planning efforts and your emergency planning efforts down the road, too. So that's another tip of the helmet there on that type of issue. So moving on just a little bit, I'm assuming you implemented an incident command system. Did you use the National Incident Management System or just a straight ICS model? Or what did you use, and how did that implementation affect your Emergency Operations Center operation?
Right, we do, and we always use the NIMS model, and of course, when we go to a declaration of emergency, that shifts and it brings the fire and EMS under the scope of the county and things like that to accomplish the goal. In our EOC, we're transitioning from annexes to ESF functions, as well as the state's doing the same thing. I mean, our state agency is making that transition, and we're doing that because people have been, working at it for so long under annexing that, bringing in ESF, there's some realignment issues that we've got to go through. Fortunately for Cecil County, is our partners are strong. So we had, brought into the EOC, we had our DPW, we had our social services department were here, law enforcement was here, field operations for EMS and fire were both here. So we had all that, and the span of control, did not exceed, that 5 to 7 number that, that became unmanageable. So it worked, that works out very well for us, especially in our center, So the people that designed our center were really forward thinking, and it lays out very well. It's not just a bunch of desks with name tents on it.
Great. The use of NIM seems to be somewhat challenging for some folks, but I think especially in large-scale events or multi-jurisdictional, certainly large geographical events, you've got to be using the gold standard, which is NIMS, for that.
Well, I agree, and I tell you, when we start doing those things, and one of the things that we did see in the first snowfall was the state declaration of emergency, and that's been a while. And all of a sudden, if you're not paying attention to finance, because you're not paying attention to NIMS, you are way behind the curve. And it's not easy sometimes, to get someone from the treasurer's office to come sit in the EOC, and they really need to be there so that they have an appreciation for how the county is moving and what they're doing. because the end result is, you know, that treasurer's office is going to see, you know, this accounting of expenditures that we're turning into the state that are going to, you know, be subject to audit in the future. And we don't want the check that comes, you know, from FEMA saying, hey, great job, thanks for your effort, here's your reimbursement of, you know, $500,000. And say, oh, by the way, we're going to audit that just to make sure everything was done well. You know, you've got to be on top of the system and make sure that all of the components and NIMS are included in your overall disaster.
And that's probably one of the largest forgotten pieces is that financial piece. And you've actually jumped ahead of my list of things to ask you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's quite all right. It's actually refreshing to hear someone take that proactive a stance on the financial impact. And in fact, that's one of the questions I have to ask you about is what was the financial impact? And, you know, we don't have to talk dollars and cents, but is this event unplanned for, unexpected type winter event? Is this going to impact your 2010 budget, and where do you see that going?
Well, it is, and it has, and that's significant. You know, these, you know, a county, and you know, I'm not DPW, but you know, I know what our director of DPW, you know, puts in his contingency planning for snow removal. Well, that went out the door in December. And he had to go back for reallocation of funds, you know, for the second storm. And 4 days later, you know, he had to stand there in front of the county commissioners and go, I need more, and we're going to continue to need more. And that's a challenge because, you know, the country is in this financial crisis, and depending on who you listen to, climbing out or staying level or, you know, whatever the case may be, and the local jurisdictions are no different. So when you add a big punch like this to, you know, to that budget, and you start reallocating in a rural area like this $400,000 and $500,000 at a time per storm, you're going to have to make adjustments somewhere along the line, and you know, between now and July 1st, that's for sure.
And it's tough to put that away in the planning process, in your budgetary process. And as we've seen, at least here in Western New York, there's been a lot of scrutiny of public service and public safety budgeting, and whether or not people are willing to, well, for lack of a better term, if they're willing to pay for that level of preparedness or pay for that level of vigilance, if you will. And it's got to be especially difficult when you encounter severe storms like you folks have that really aren't on the top of your list of hazards to prepare for. And so many people might be saying that, well, you don't need to put that much away. We haven't seen a storm like this since 1996, so we're not going to see another one. Yeah, how do you answer those types of assertions from the public? It's a very difficult situation to be in.
Well, and I agree. And, you know, I work for five county commissioners, and it's my responsibility to make sure that this county is prepared and is served in the event of an emergency. It's also my responsibility to present to them the best options for that preparedness. Now, I'm a 52-year-old guy. I don't mind looking somebody square in the eye and go, look, you're wrong. You've got to do this. Now, they can also look me back and say, you're my employee. You'll do it this way. And I respect that, and I'm okay with that. But my responsibility is to give them all the options. My responsibility is not to present them with a budget that is so pie in the sky that I can cover all responsibilities. I don't think that that's good budget management. I don't think that's a good way, you know, for somebody in my position to treat, you know, their superiors, their elected officials. However, they have to deal with their constituents. And as we saw, you know, in these past couple of weeks, the constituents run 180 degrees. From the ones that go, thank you so much for getting a plow down here on the second day. We understand it's tough. We'll shovel out to, you know, to the single lane that they've made. 180 degrees from that is two 25-year-old people screaming at me on the phone at 11 o'clock at night because they can't get home to sit in front of their fireplace, and they demand that we respond immediately and open their road. At the end of the day, you just make sure that you tell those elected officials, here's the input we're receiving, the good and the bad, but here's what your employees are doing, and here's the hours that they have worked and the number of man hours and crews that are on the street clearing, responding to emergencies, and doing things outside of their normal job profile to serve your citizens.
And I think that, budgeting and the financial aspect of emergency planning and emergency management oftentimes gets glossed over or doesn't get the amount of respect that it needs until after the event when, as you said, you're looking for reimbursement and being ready for that impending audit. And having been on the receiving end of those, I can commiserate with you. They're not mm-hmm. something you want to go through.
Right.
Moving on then, I guess I want to put you on the spot just a little bit.
Go ahead.
You talked to us an awful lot about all the really good things that have happened. Can you give us a snapshot of some of the logistical issues or other issues that came up that weren't expected, and how did you manage them?
Well, if you go at it with a you have to start every day with a positive. And at least if it's not going to be positive when it looks you in the face, you have to look at the day as it's going to be a positive. And we're here to help the people. I'll give you an example. We had a phone call. A commercial ambulance service was transporting a gentleman to dialysis on the third day. It was time. Had to go to dialysis. They barely made it out of where he was, and the way the road looked, they weren't going to get back. And my response was, well, where are you going to take him? Well, we're going to take him home. Well, that may not be an option. What are you doing to make other plans? And I spoke with the owner of the company, and I said, look, you know, you're out. You've got him to a definitive care center. He's getting the best care possible. He may need, or his family may need, to make alternate plans, you know, for a place for him to stay. We got into the family issues, and that really wasn't the best option. They'd had no other options but to come home. So we muster the troops. We get a fire crew down there. We get a medic crew down there. We get a Humvee crew down there. And when that private ambulance arrives, we do what we have to do to open the road up as far as we possibly can until the plow gets stuck. And we get the Humvee. We load the gentleman into the Humvee, and they bust through and take him right to the door. And we have enough crews there to get him in and make him comfortable with his family, and we bust our way back out. There are challenges. The potential for things going wrong in that situation, quite a few number of issues could go wrong, let alone transferring the guy from an ambulance into a Humvee, you know, to make that final transport. But that was the need of the family at the time, and it was the need of the gentleman at the time. So you weigh those risks. And you might have to just roll the dice a little bit and do what you believe is the right thing.
And that really does bring me to my next point. At what point during your event did you make the decision to switch from a standard of response to a sufficiency of response, knowing your resources, your capabilities, your personnel, and given the environment that you were working in? Was there a time that you had to sit back and say, all right, we're not going to be responding to routine events, or we're going to change our triage model or emergency medical dispatch model or whatever you happen to be using? Switching from that standard of response to sufficiency response, did it happen with you?
Well, and we did that. And actually, the gentleman's just sitting in the outer room here. We have our chair of our fire chiefs for the county. And one of the things that we did during the storm, he was part of our EOC, and we relocated him from the EOC into the dispatch center, so that under his authority, we modified fire responses. So you know, where we would have normally sent two engines on an auto fire, we sent one. Or whatever he chose to do at the time. We did the same thing. We use emergency medical dispatch as our protocol for dispatching ambulances. That allows us to, you know, to in a sense go to sufficiency of responses. We did not implement, and I made the decision that we were not going to implement no-go responses. And if you follow the news and some of the blogs, some of the areas that did choose to do that and say, no, we're not going to send you an ambulance, we had some unfortunate outcomes there. So my initiative was if somebody calls for an ambulance, they're going to get a visit. They may not get an ambulance, but somebody's going to be knocking at that front door. Now, that may be a tiered response. It may not be immediate, although immediate may be an hour. It may be delayed, and that may be 3 or 4 hours if, you know, if they've got a splinter in their finger or stubbed their toe or something like that. They would get that delayed response. I think when you make those decisions, you know, you have to make them for good reasons. You have to be prepared to stand behind them so that your dispatch staff, you know, are in a position where they can make good decisions, and your operational crews are in a position that they can execute those decisions and do it well when you're doing that priority one, priority two, priority three type of response.
Well, let's shift gears then and talk about the other end of that, where, you know, I've been in emergency services for 25 years. I know you've been in for quite a bit longer than that. You'd like to think you've seen everything, but it never ceases to amaze me that at the height of a critical event, a snowstorm or whatever the situation is, that someone will call for that toenail pain or the splinter in the finger type event. You mentioned you've got to be planning for those people to come in and managing those situations. So looking at the other side of that now is what was the impact on the local hospitals or receiving facilities in response to an increased patient load if that did occur?
Well, locally, we did not see a significant loading of the emergency department. We did early on in the storm see an effort to move as the hospital prepared to move some people out, and we assisted with some of that. We also saw during the height of the storm some of the people who were transported in, not admitted, but perhaps discharged after, you know, 6, 8, 10 hours, and being elderly, sitting in the waiting room in the hospital, reaching out, going, "Can you help us get these people home?" That's a problem, because once we leave in a storm, once we leave that hospital, you know, we own that person. You know, we've got them. So we get to their address, and, you know, all of a sudden they have that half a mile long driveway that's drifted over. That's no better than some of our county roads that weren't opened, you know, for 6 days. What do you do with that person now? We try to avoid some of that, you know, just using some technology at hand to, you know, to look at addresses and look at houses and look what, you know, do the Google map, if you will, topography to see where they are and make, you know, good decisions on that. And we did have some people that just ended up boarding, you know, at the hospital. And the hospital did a great job. They just, you know, did what they had to do to keep them there and keep them comfortable and keep them fed. And then, you know, they made other arrangements for discharge when the storm was over.
And I agree with that. I'm a big fan of sheltering in place whenever possible, rather than taking someone out or taking a group out into an unknown environment without the sure known value of being able to get them to where they're going and to safety. You're right. You run into the possibility of being stranded in a worse environment than where they came from. And I think that's a difficult risk to balance. And there's an event going on right now in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and their EMS. I don't know if you've heard about it or not. And Jamie, if you want to chime in a little bit on this, this would be it would be great. Is an ambulance crew couldn't get to a given location for upwards, I think, 30 hours, and repeated calls to 911, and the person couldn't walk out to the ambulance, and unfortunately, that citizen died, and right. The EMS service has taken quite a bit of a beating in some mainstream media from their local emergency service provider, local emergency managers, and the mayor.
And that's what I was alluding to before.
No, I read that story, and I was, you know, I was most alarmed by how the providers were kind of left hanging out there. You know, they got their ambulances stuck. Are they supposed to leave their ambulance unattended? And there's a lot of decisions here that somebody could have passed up the chain and let someone higher up make the decision. Should we try to walk in or not? And, you know, it's easy in hindsight to second guess decisions made in the heat of a moment. And certainly this was an unusual and unfortunate situation. And I think that's my take on it is, you know, I always try to take these and say, what lessons can be learned by the provider on the street? And how can they apply this if they run into something similar in the future where they are blocked from getting to their patient for one reason or another? What should they keep in mind if this ever presents itself? And I think, you know, my only lesson from this is I have not seen anything about the ambulances talking up the chain of command and getting advice from higher up, but I have to think they must have. If they got stuck, they had to call for assistance.
Well, here, I mean, yeah, Jamie, in Cecil County, I mean, we had a lot of interface with both our fire and our EMS crews, you know, with questions like that. And that just comes from, you know, from managing, you know, an emergency of this scale. You're put in a position by them that, that you can reach out, you know, to the partner response agencies and get a feel, you know, for whether you can say, yep, you know, go ahead and hike in, or wait a minute, let us call the residents and see if we're still in a critical situation. Or do we have time to get that rubber tired front end loader, you know, from 5 miles away brought to your area? So we did have, you know, the crews reaching out, usually through wireless technology, sometimes on the radio, sometimes not, but making those inquiries.
Well, a lot of this, I think, comes down to the, you know, of course, the preparedness that we've been talking about. But it does come down to the citizens, the people, and their expectations. And someone had an expectation that even in the face of a blizzard situation, that we needed to get to this person. And I don't want to shortchange that. And as Jamie said, we don't know all the details. We don't know what the decisions were based on. But it comes to me down to that shift from a standard of response to a sufficiency of response. So what people expect to happen based on everyday situations may not be there and may not be able to happen. There might not be any way for emergency service responders to reach a location. Now, we're certainly not talking about an event on the size and scope of Hurricane Katrina, but as we know, it doesn't have to be an event that large or that devastating to prevent us in some cases or slow us down significantly from making that type of response or making that type of connection with the citizen. And folks have got to be able to have alternative means of taking care of themselves or staying in their home, sheltering in place, whatever the case may be. Now, it certainly may not have made a difference in this situation that we're learning about in Pittsburgh, but I think it's an important mindset that should be added to our public awareness campaign is how to take care of yourself or knowing that emergency response may not be there as fast or as immediate as we'd like them to be.
Well, and that goes, you know, that goes with the original announcements or the original warnings or forecasts of a storm, you know, that these, you know, this is going to be a travel impeding storm. We are going to see 12 inches of snow in the next 6 hours, we're going to see 12 inches of snow on top of that in the following 24 hours. It will be disabling. It was disabling in 96, if you remember, and it was equally as disabling, you know, this time. However, I don't want to say the culture has changed, but the citizenry is used to a certain level of response, and you have to communicate to them when you're not going to provide that level of response. I'm not, you know, we did not get to the point where we failed to respond or said we were not responding to any calls. And I don't think that that's our job to do that. Our job is to make the response because that request was there for the response. But that response, as you said, does not need to be the normal response. They don't normally, if they are used to seeing an engine and a medic unit, they may see just an engine because we've got more engines than we do medic units. And you know what? I don't have, as a paramedic, I don't have a problem doing whatever I have to do with four firefighters transporting a lady outside somehow in a sled in a cardboard box, keeping her warm and protected, to the side of the fire engine and putting her on a life pack monitor in that fire engine, and that fire engine taking me to the hospital or taking me to rendezvous to an ambulance. We're still caring for that individual. May not be on a stretcher, you know, wrapped up in a blanket on a 2-inch mattress, but you know, she's seated, she's seat belted, she is wrapped in a blanket, and she's receiving care. That's the mission. We've got to provide the care.
And that really does speak to being innovative in these situations. And as much as I think the public has got to be innovative and self-sufficient in some cases in these situations, our responders have got to be able to think outside the box too and utilize that engine company in the fashion that you've described, rather than in the traditional response mode of using a medic unit or an ambulance for that transfer. And I agree with you wholeheartedly on that. I want to jump ahead really to my final set of questions, if I can. We're going on 45 minutes or so. And now the storm's over. Mr. Brooks, the storm is over. You are into the demobilize mode and the recovery mode. What do you do next?
We're doing a lot of paperwork because what we're doing is, you know, is reaching out to the fire companies, to the towns, to the police agencies, to all our sister agencies within the county, and accumulating all of their financial data, their work schedule, their employee numbers, all of those kind of things. We're inundated with paperwork. We're also, you know, going through and inventorying the things that we've used and resupplying, because I'm signing an awful lot of purchase orders, you know, this week to get that done. We're cleaning and restocking, you know, get the sleeping bags laundered, the air mattresses, you know, deflated and folded up, and the cots put away. All those things are going into play because we may have to put them back into play in, you know, about 4 more days. At least we're looking at that. We're watching that storm, you know, come up. Our Department of Public Works, they're scrambling to, you know, to get the salt domes back, you know, to a point that they've got a good usable, you know, commodity there. All of our fleet maintenance people are still working, doing, you know, some of the repairs from some snow damage. It's amazing the number of windshield wipers that we went through. We probably went through 3 pairs of windshield wipers per unit in my agency. And that's remarkable. You don't think about those kind of things. So fleet maintenance had to get a couple more cases of those in. So, you recoup, you take inventory, you do a quick AAR and have staff meetings. This is what was good. This is what was bad. Here's what we use. This is what we need. Let's get our act back together. We're going to do that, you know, till close of business today. Everybody gets a nice weekend to themselves for a change, maybe. and on Monday, we'll start at it again.
And it's so interesting to hear you talk about the next storm here in Rochester. We don't count, it's Rochester, New York. We don't count on winter being over until we're well into the month of May, let's say. So I certainly feel your pain about waiting for the next one and when the next shoe is going to drop. And that is really the end of my prepared questions for you, Richard. I appreciate you being here. I will look forward to reading your after action report if it's published on the web or available for public consumption, because it sounds like we're going to have a success story out of this major event in your area.
I think so. I think by and large, it's a success story. I think we'll have a few disgruntled, and that's okay. We can do that. But by and large, the citizen population was taken care of very well. They were protected, they were cared for, and they were served by the people they expect to be served by.
Richard, one last question from me. Is there any message you would pass on to either the responders or other emergency managers out there that this or other events have taught for you that you might say is just a word of advice to people that are out there working on the street or dealing with events like this?
Oh, you probably already hit that, and that was think outside of the box. You know, don't let anybody put you in a box and keep you there. We're successful because our business, be it fire department, EMS, combination, career volunteer, emergency management, emergency operations, or in my case, emergency services, we have got to be flexible, forward-thinking, out-of-the-box type people. That's when we'll do the best job. You know, when people come at you with something that you did not predict, and you can sit back for a few minutes and go, here's a way we can deal with this, and make it work and refine it for the next time, that's how we're going to have success. People who enter this industry, and I call it an industry because they're such a great group of people, and we're one family across this country. I don't care who you talk to, if they wear a uniform, we're all one part of an organization. We do the right thing for the right reason every day. That's what we're here for.
Well, thank you, Mr. Brooks or Richard for coming on and spending an hour with us. I appreciate that. And Jamie, for putting this together really at the last minute. I appreciate your help. And when I reached out the other day to call you, I was just kind of looking to get your insight on your end of the game, and to have a special guest come on and give us this level of detail is really outstanding. I think it's going to be beneficial for all the listeners.
Well, thanks. I appreciate the invitation, and you know, Jamie, I get to see you on a regular basis, so it's fun to have him pick my brain when he wants to. But it's a pleasure talking to you. I do have some friends in Rochester who called to harass me because apparently you have not had what we've had in the last couple of weeks.
No, if I had some wood here in my office, I would knock on it because we have not seen the kind of winter. Man, I don't want it. Okay, I've had enough. You know. It's 41 degrees right now. The sun is out. My son's out shooting basketball in a driveway, and I'm going to take that right as long as we can.
Good for you. Enjoy that. Take care.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Richard. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So there you have it, a bit of a wrap-up, and just looking at things from a little bit higher above what we might as a normal street responder, kind of thinking about how our management and our emergency response directors are thinking about major situations and disasters, natural disasters, storms, whatever the case may be. How do we deal with changes in the stresses that get in our way of doing our job? And so I hope that's given you kind of some insight on how things are done, how decisions are made farther up the food chain. Remember, you can always get back to me and let me know what you think of this or any other episode. Send me in those emails. Send me in a comment to podmedic@mac.com or call in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Get you in here to the MedicCast voicemail line. And I also want to remind all of you, you can always leave comments for me as well over on the Facebook fan page. We're kind of pushing towards 1,000 fans over there. Are you going to be part of that first 1,000? I think you can be. Just head on over to the MedicCast Facebook fan page. If you're on Facebook, just search MedicCast. And you can also find links right on the MedicCast blog as well. Right on the right-hand side, you scroll down, you'll see a link to take you right to that and become a fan of the MedicCast on Facebook. Also, don't forget, I'm looking forward to seeing all of you coming up this week at EMS Today. So if you're going to be at the conference, shoot me an email, let me know, and follow what time we're going to be doing shows. I'll be tweeting about where I am and what I'm looking at. So if I'm not in the booth and recording, I'm going to be out on the floor looking at stuff. So if you follow me on Twitter, you can probably track me down based on which booth I've been at. And if I've been in a booth and I'm not there when you get there, ask them which way I went. So just follow up on what I'm doing that way. Twitter.com/podmedic, also Facebook.com/podmedic for my personal Facebook page. And I look forward to seeing as many listeners as possible down at the EMS Today conference in Baltimore. No song this week since we're just wrapping things up and it's running a little long with that interview segment. I will just remind all of you to keep checking back here at the MedicCast. I'll have a lot of great stuff from the conference recorded live down there, and you can follow that on Ustream if you can't make it to the conference. But in the meantime, I will just get it back up here on the show in the coming weeks, so stay tuned. If you aren't able to make it to the conference, you can definitely hear the segments here on the MedicCast over the coming weeks. So stay tuned to MedicCast.com/blog for more updates. And in the meantime, I want to remind all of you, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Don't forget, folks, if you can't make it to the conference, at least remember scene safety and BSI.